Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be looking at the recurrent war crimes in the neglected Sudan conflict. I'm joined by a very special guest, Jehan Henry, a human rights lawyer and independent researcher that has focused on most of her research on Sudan and South Sudan. She's a former director in the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, responsible for work on Sudan and South Sudan and Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Chad, and Mali. She has also previously worked as an advisor in Sudan's transitional government Ministry of Justice. Since late 21, she has worked with the various human rights organizations across Africa. And also, she has also taught in many other places. I think she also teaches at Columbia University as a lecturer in law. Jehan, you've had a very impressive resume and career. I'm very, very pleased to have you join me, and I look forward to a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, brilliant. So let's start off. So Sudan has been, this civil war has been raging now for nearly 2 years. I think it'll be 2 years in April. And can you provide a comprehensive assessment of the current, you know, situation in Sudan?
Well, it's really beyond imaginably dire. It is a dire situation. The war does not look like it's set to end anytime soon. As most of you and your listeners would know, it started 2 years ago in April 2023 between the Sudanese army, SAF, and the large paramilitary, the Rapid Support Forces, that had been created by the SAF, by al-Bashir 10 years before, actually. And so this paramilitary had, over time, accumulated power, namely through the person of its leader, Hameti. Eventually they started to disagree, the RSF and the SAF, mainly Hameti and al-Burhan, who's the head of the SAF, started to disagree over a number of things during the transitional period. And there were signs of RSF building up, and there were various moments of tension, and the whole thing erupted into violence in April 2023. And the immediate effect was felt in Khartoum. And this is the first time in Sudanese history that the capital Khartoum was touched by war, at least in modern times. Mm-hmm. You know, for many decades, the wars have been in the so-called the peripheries of the country. So out west in Darfur, down south in the Nuba Mountains, Blue Nile, and of course in South Sudan, Southern Sudan had the longest war until it became independent in 2011. So this new war, the latest war in Khartoum, was unprecedented. The effects could be felt immediately with explosive weapons being used in populated areas, people struggling to get evacuated or to move to a safer place. And of course, with each passing week, more damage, more destruction, the war ended up spreading very quickly. First in Darfur, in West Darfur, it took on its own life because of local dynamics happening in West Darfur. It was like fuel, easily sparked. And with the war in Khartoum, that was the sort of the trigger for renewed violence in West Darfur that ended up being intensely ethnicized, with some genocidal episodes to it, which I can talk about more later. But the situation evolved from there, and I'm kind of giving you the brief summary of what it looked like. And over the last 2 years, the country has essentially consolidated power under each of these two forces in roughly sort of two halves of the country. So the north and the east is for the Sudanese armed forces. Their new base is in Port Sudan on the Red Sea. The west part of the country and much of the central breadbasket area was under the rapid support forces. Now, there is a central zone. It's a place called Jazeera State, just south of Khartoum, that is disputed. It's changed hands several times. Disputed is the wrong word. It's embattled. It's changed hands a couple of times, and it has come with huge, suffering, war crimes, targeting, a lot of violence against the civilians in Jazeera. First, the RSF took control of it. And then SAF has now recently made inroads recapturing parts of it and also trying to recapture Khartoum. SAF has now taken much of Omdurman and neighborhoods that had been under the RSF before. Now SAF is controlling. So it's a true dynamic front line in some of these areas, whereas in other areas, it's not a dynamic war. It's just, under the control of the respective force. But I should also add that the SAF has been using its bombing, its aerial bombardment technique, which it used always in its past wars, again, in this war. And there's been a lot of airstrikes in Darfur, especially in recent weeks. And looking back at the statistics from 2024, some organizations have collected information about airstrikes. It looks like they were much more intense all throughout the year than in the first part of the war. So that's the situation where you have, the airstrikes, which are of course terrorizing the population where those are happening and people are having to flee to camps. And then there's ground fighting, in Khartoum, parts of Jazeera, and also, of course, in Darfur, there is one town left that has SAF-aligned forces, and that's El Fasher in North Darfur. So those are major hotspots where fighting is very active. I guess that's sort of what I can do to summarize how the situation is. It's not a country. It is far from at peace. It doesn't look like either side wants to go to the table yet. They both seem to think that they're going to win this war, even though everyone can agree that Sudan is much too vast to actually have either side fully militarily conquer. It just seems that Sudan has never had any force in complete control over all the territory.
It does seem bleak. If you look at them, if you look at how conflicts end, sometimes people look at the kind of power dynamics between the opposing forces, but it looks like RSF and SAF seems to have a power between them, and like Riley said, both parties feel like they can win the war, and usually kind of prolongs the. But there's something you mentioned, in terms of the head of SAF was actually when I set up RSF. So, but in what is the ultimate goal? So, is the ultimate goal power and control? What is the ultimate goal for both of
us? So there's a few things to point out. I mean, first of all, with regard to the powers of each side, I think most people will agree that that's because of external support. Both sides have external support, and so they're able to keep getting what they need to keep up the fight. Now, what is their ultimate goal? This is the mystery. For me, I've been asking this question since the beginning, and I found people saying different things at different times. I think it's clearer for the SAF. They want to regain control over the country. They represent themselves as the institution of the nation nationhood itself, that they are the real Sudan, and that they are the reliable military institution that, you know, the world has been dealing with for all these decades. Now, that claim to legitimacy, in a way, this war has given more legitimacy or more popular credibility to the SAF, whereas historically, so much of the Sudanese population was actually victimized by the SAF, the SAF's tactics, and I'm using SAF into sort of this generic term. I mean, it is the National Army, but it is also wrapped up in sort of the National Congress Party, which is the former ruling party of Omar al-Bashir, the president formerly, who was ousted in 2019 and replaced. I am referring to SAF as kind of the bundle of leadership that includes that Islamic party, the National Congress Party. And of course, there are a lot of other sort of more hardline Islamist actors out there who are also manipulating the situation and would like to see SAF win and would like to control again. So Sudan and Sudanese history, political Islam played a very important role. Sudan in some ways was the big experiment, and it created a lot of problems and a lot of human rights violations, a lot of repression, a lot of political and civil rights repression for many, many years. And that's part of what brought the revolution to the forefront and part of why al-Bashir was ousted. So now we're in this situation where SAF is saying, but we are the nation. So we are the pot, you know, and they are getting more and more credibility from people, it looks like. The reason is because the RSF, on the other side, the RSF doesn't have much political legitimacy, of course, because they have been committing horrific crimes, looting, rapes, killings, just absolute no respect for any of the laws of war or protection of civilians. The RSF's behavior and their legacy as well. The RSF originated in Darfur as the so-called Janjaweed during the Darfur atrocities from 20 years ago. And the leader of the RSF, Hemeti, basically was given the green light by former President al-Bashir to form this new force called the Rapid Support Forces and given a lot of resources to professionalize it and give them a lot of equipment. And so that's how they came up. They came up because Bashir wanted them. But in the current situation, both sides are relying on external support. Both sides are also vying for sort of domestic support. But a moment ago, I was trying to explain that I think the SAF is sort of able to capitalize on this war in a certain way, because they do represent the nation. They say that they do represent the nation in a way that RSF cannot say. RSF is a militia entity. So what do they want? The SAF, I think, wants to recapture the government and to reinstitute the same structure that existed before. And the irony here, of course, is that, you know, that is the exact structure that opponents of the regime and the entire revolution that brought Bashir down objected to. And it's a repressive structure, and it's an extractive and exploitative structure of government. And that problem is very much documented over decades. So the prospect of sort of just bringing that back into place is, of course, not a happy one for many observers. But because we are in this state of chaos, violence, and emergency right now, I think people are not necessarily, you know, swayed by that concern as much as just stopping the war. So whatever it takes, stop the war. So SAF wants to get back into power. RSF, this is a more complicated or more mysterious question, because at different times in the last couple of years, depending on who you ask, you might get a different answer. For a while, people were saying, look, Hemeti does not have presidential ambitions. He actually just wants to, you know, oust what was there and make sure that the Islamists never come back. And some of the rhetoric coming out of Hemeti and the leadership there is, you know, we want a secular government. We want the Islamists out. We are happy to hand power over to the civilians, and, you know, and so forth. But it is very difficult for most, I think, objective observers, especially the non-Sudanese observers who are, you know, just sort of watching over the years. I feel most people find it very difficult to believe that the remnants of the Janjaweed that committed the atrocities 20 years ago in Darfur could ever possibly be able to form a government in any kind of coherent way, and that there isn't any legitimacy here. Of course, many Sudanese also feel this way. And as I said, the tactic of their abuses has also turned so many people against the RSF. So does Hemeti actually want to institute a government? Do we really believe that he wants to just hand power over to any civilians? What we do know is that he has an enormous empire, and it's built on gold. He has been masterful in exploiting that gold from across the country all throughout the transitional period and before. And he enjoys support from the Emirates, or at least has enjoyed support from the Emirates for a long time, with records showing that there have been weapons transfers going directly in via Chad. And perhaps via other places. And so, you know, he's getting the support. He's being sort of, I think, propped up external malign actors all have their own game plan. And some of them find it convenient to put their bets on the RSF. So I don't know what the RSF really wants, but I find it difficult to believe that there is any sort of possibility of legitimate governance there, based on what we've seen from them and what we know about them.
Two questions come at a tie into each one another. So we see that there's a battle for legitimacy. But then again, like you rightly mentioned at first, RSF has received the largest of the blame when it comes to like human rights violation, looking at his history and then looking at his current tactics and then I think it's received the greater condemnation when it comes to ethnic, the genocide and stuff. But from your explanation as well, it looks like SAF is not an innocent act as well. SAF's in the area, but it's also causing some kind of a human rights violation. Yeah. So I want to tie that into the external actors. And do you think Sudan, like the Sahel, it's becoming... I'm glad you mentioned Chad as well, because I think there's some kind of ethnic group in Chad that is also in Sudan that is... and then the UAE and all of that. Do you think Sudan is becoming a space for geopolitical competition, whereby these external parties are playing out that geopolitical game that could be prolonging the conflict?
Yes, definitely. I think Sudan is some of these geopolitical rivalries that we see across the region are being played out in Sudan, for sure. So the SAF traditionally is supported by the Egyptian government. And it's almost like useless to ask the question, how do you know that? Because everyone will say, well, we just know that. It's always been the case. The Sudanese Air Force is tiny, but there are lots of planes being deployed. There are lots of pilots here. This is Egyptian. Getting into the nitty gritty of all the ways in which support is happening, I think when it comes to Egypt is a little tricky. But everybody kind of accepts that, yes, Egypt is supporting the SAF politically, if not materially.
Militarily, yeah.
And then we also have SAF with its relations, you know, with Turkey, with Iran. The news reported how Burhan went to Iran to get drones and other material over a couple of times over the last couple of years. And these are sort of allies, Qatar maybe to a certain extent as well. And then on the RSF side, there is, of course, the UAE, as I already mentioned, And there may be sympathetic neighbors. People will say, oh, sure, Ethiopia would be ready to support the RSF. I don't want to manufacture, evidence for anything, but this is what people are saying. And they were imagining how the RSF is essentially, their strategy is to try to make a corridor across to Ethiopia and use that for resupplying. They already have the Chad corridor for their supplies. And then the question will be South Sudan. How is South Sudan going to play this out? And it's very complex because South Sudan and Sudan are inextricably linked over their oil resources. So if the Port Sudan government, which is of course the SAF side, if they are unhappy with the South Sudanese, they have certain power over what they, bits of the puzzle that they control, and the same goes for the RSF. And right now the RSF does have a presence over most of that border, so they could certainly disrupt the oil, and they do have control over parts of it. So this is a resource that all parties have some say in, and it requires them to cooperate in the same way that the Nile waters do in the
Hawthorn.
So there are a lot of geopolitics in this region, Horn of Africa, Sahel, Middle East more broadly. It's a very dynamic part of the world, and Sudan is kind of a litmus for it, or it kind of shows up in Sudan.
What we've seen as well is a lot of people have complained that Sudan is not receiving the kind of media coverage, global media coverage, that it should be receiving compared to other stuff. Do you agree with that? And then why is it so?
Well, I think there are a lot of different reasons. Part of it is, of course, the already existing wars in the world that are taking up more attention and bandwidth, namely Gaza, Israel's war in Palestine, and then Ukraine before that, and how much attention that took, especially from the West, from this country in the United States, where I am right now. So those two conflicts have dominated public awareness of our foreign affairs here. And people struggle to see why the United States should care about a war in Africa. And you know what the current President Trump has said about African countries in the past. And, it's not really a surprise that he's not talking about Sudan in those ways. And we don't have any human rights driven politics right now in this country. This is a big sort of shift in the world. Multilateralism is waning, and there are a lot of reasons to be very alarmed about all of those modern sort of most recent trends there. But I won't blame these big picture things. I also think that when it comes to Sudan, because it's an African war, because it has been in the news before as a war, there's some kind of fatigue. And there's also, I think, just you can chalk it up to racism and say a war in Europe is more interesting than a war in Africa. And I think that the world is still in that place. And that's how the media is still in that place. I will give like the New York Times credit and other major outlets, Jazeera, for doing a really great coverage on Sudan. But that doesn't necessarily translate into the kind of pressure that would, that generates political action. When it comes to American leadership, we're still trying to see how the change in government is going to impact the work on Sudan. Presumably there are opportunities as the wider regional issues become more clear cut and resolved. But I just don't know. I mean, I don't, there are people out there saying, look, at least it's clear, under the Trump administration, their positions may be more clear, and this will help move things along, that there may be more interest in just sort of ending the conflict in the Middle East, and that might translate into more interest in ending the conflict in Sudan. It should. I just can't see exactly how it's going to play out yet. Most of the regional efforts from the African Union, IGAD, have not really, and neighboring countries like Egypt and South Sudan, they haven't really gained any traction, mainly because the two sides don't really want to lay down their weapons, and there isn't enough concerted energy on this to stop the malign external actors like the UAE and others from being involved, taking sides. So there needs to be some, coordination and a very sort of strong political will to settle this, and some leadership. The U.S. could conceivably still play that role, but I'm struggling at this moment to see exactly how and by, who will lead and what the,
Speaking of the U.S. and speaking of Trump, then the unpredictability of Trump. We had a recent recording of an episode where we were looking at his surprising precision strike in Somalia against ISIS, because we also have another episode where we were looking at what is presidency second Trump 2.0 is going to mean for Africa. So I was quite surprised with that. But then looking at how, again, his actions and what we can see, how democracy is receding, not only in Africa, we're looking at in Europe, we're looking at Trump. Let's look at Trump and look at how he's acting in a way that is authoritarian and dictatorial. Does that also have some sort of impact on, by emboldening this kind of Hemeti and all of this RSF, and say, look, this
man is doing what's happening in Congo right now.
Yeah, exactly. The M23. Yeah.
Situation. You got to wonder. I mean, did somebody sort of say, "Oh, this is a good time"? With Trump, I think Trump's bluster definitely emboldens, people, leaders that have dictatorial characteristics, or the world's autocrats, for sure. Yeah, and I mean, I the war in Sudan started before Trump, but I think with Sudan, the question is really going to be, how is Trump's administration's resolution or posture around the wider Middle East, how is that going to have a direct impact on Sudan? How is it going to play out in Sudan? Is it true that the RSF might feel happy about Trump? I don't know. I mean, SAF equally might. I can't tell you how many people over the years in both Sudan and South Sudan have said, oh, the Republicans in the United States are much better for Africa, because they remember the days of the CPA, which was under the Bush administration. That's sort of a feeling that often comes across when speaking to people. And I wouldn't be surprised if everyone thinks that they can make good under Trump, because remember, it's chaos and unpredictability. So maybe there's an opportunity for everyone. I'm not sure yet that there's, the U.S.
You mentioned EGOT. Yeah, you mentioned EGOT. I know EGOT had tried to intervene in the past. So let's tie EGOT into the African Union, broadly speaking, and look at how they're managing the situation. And then tie that also into I wanted to ask you first to begin with, what is the scale of the humanitarian crisis in terms what's the scale? Let's begin with that. What is the scale?
So the population is always estimated around 45 million, at least half are facing starvation. 10 million, or I think the number is actually more like 12 million now, have been forced to flee their homes. And somewhere around 3 million are out of the country. They cross borders. So that's to Chad, South Sudan, some in Ethiopia, and a lot in Egypt. And then, there are a lot of diaspora anyway. So these are very staggering numbers, but the number of people facing acute hunger and famine is incredibly shocking. And it It's so high, and it covers such a vast territory. It's not just in one part of North Darfur that people are facing famine. It's all over where there's a dynamic front line. There's famine, hunger problems in the Nuba Mountains that my former colleagues at Human Rights Watch recently documented. And you know, that region of the country has seen a huge influx of IDPs from Khartoum and Medini and other parts of the country where there was violence. And so they now have to feed all these newcomers, hundreds of thousands actually. And they're not prepared for that. So that's one example, but you'll find sort of humanitarian problems and suffering throughout the country. There's really no part of the country where things are really normal anymore, because even the sleepy towns or the ones that were doing fine and seem untouched by conflict in Eastern Sudan, they now have so many IDPs that has put a lot of pressure on things like water, medicine. And then the other part of this conversation is the fact that the UN and other aid operations have not been allowed to operate freely. So forget about what Trump has just done, which is to close
aid. Yeah.
Completely, which has incredibly far-ranging impacts. But even before that, we were dealing with the tendency of the Sudanese government, the SAF side, to block aid and make it very difficult for people to get visas and provide aid. On the RSF side, there's been more willingness to beckon aid groups to come in. The problem is that the UN doesn't go in without the permission of the government, which is the de facto government in Port Sudan. So that ended up being a big complication. And it's a very typical Sudan story, I have to say. We've seen this though in history with South Sudan War, the restriction of aid and the obstruction and the stealing aid. So the humanitarian situation really bad in terms of killings from either fighting or explosive weapons, bombs. It's we don't know, because the figures, the statistics are so rare. There was a report put out at the end of last year, end of 2024, from the London School of Hygiene, I think it was, saying that they estimated 60,000 had been killed in Khartoum state alone, which is just one tiny part of the country. So you can imagine maybe hundreds of thousands. The death toll's not counted. It's not known. But, you know, deaths would happen from the deprivation of humanitarian aid and basic goods and services, and deprivation of medical attention, probably more than from direct shelling and bombing. It's a much larger number than maybe we might think just from reading the news. So the humanitarian situation is really dire in Sudan. And I really worry about this closure of USAID and the impact that it's going to have. And now more and more organizations, communities are going to have to turn to other donors. And other donors may or may not have the resources. So it's a very concerning.
Well, what I'm looking at is I've been looking at it in a positive way, but now I can see it might also be in a negative way. Look at how you were talking about multilateralism and see how we are seeing configurations and reconfigurations of power structures. You see expansion in NATO, you see the BRICS expanding, you see like there's no... there's a challenge to the UN Security Council. There seems like there's a gap in leadership, in world leadership, to intervene in things like this, in issues like this. Because then again, look at it, people are just going to keep suffering, debts and all of that. Who is going to be able to intervene to put this thing down? Do you think it's just so bleak? What's the situation? Who is the best actor to go in and hurt these killings?
I know the feeling. Yeah, it does look really bleak. When we talk about protection of civilians in relation to Sudan, especially in the UN, the conversation has been very, very stilted, because there isn't much that the UN is willing to do without state consent. And, you know, Sudan is definitely not the SAF side. The de facto government is not going to want the UN to come in and do any kind of protection. The need for protection is also shifting. It's dynamic. So, you know, I think front lines. So I guess maybe backtrack for a second.
Okay.
Multilateralism is waning. That is true. It is more and more difficult for the world to come together to do things like protect civilians and do peacekeeping missions. But it's not impossible. Mm-hmm. We do see effective multilateralism in many parts of the world. There are still peacekeeping and political missions and things that are done sort of led by the UN or the AU or sub-regional organizations. So the question is, what are the opportunities for Sudan and what are people pushing for? And in conversations with the UN, I think it's been very difficult to speak about protection of civilians as such because the UN doesn't have a peacekeeping mission there anymore. It went from having three peacekeeping missions across the Sudans to having none in Sudan. So now there is still one in South Sudan and there's one in the disputed territory of Abyei. But there's nothing left in Sudan. So there's no sort of foothold that the UN can use to kind of send in, you know, boots on the ground. So instead, people are focused on how to support local peace deals, how to communicate and send support in to local actors who are mediating at the local level, things like access to markets, things like, you know, emergency funds for moving people or evacuation, and of course all the humanitarian aid. So across the Chad border, there have been convoys of different types of assistance going into Darfur to different locations. It's never enough, but there is some movement there. And then, you know, maybe there are some opportunities coming up from South Sudan into the southern part of Sudan in different locations where aid groups can access and move around to a limited degree. And in eastern part of the country, there are some humanitarian organizations, although it is difficult as an operating environment. The government, of course, allows some aid in. They want it there, and they, as long as they can control it. So the challenge is for all of these different operations to then reach even further through coordinating with people further inside the country and just do what they can, whether it's training in civilian protection methodologies about how to protect yourselves from bombings and airstrikes, or how to, you know, how to survive, you know, without communications. Of course, Starlink is all over Sudan, and there are a lot of people who have relied on Starlink. Yeah, so it's really a struggle, but it really brings to light this whole issue of localization and mutual aid. And that's what that's the whole game right now in Sudan is for assisting people. You're going to end up talking about mutual aid, local mutual aid groups, and how best to send them help.
Yeah. I was also looking at, if you look at in the, I think in the 90s, look at the civil wars in the 90s in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, look at how, particularly if you look at ECOWAS and its ECOMOG force and how they were able to intervene in places like that. So we're looking at maybe IGAD, but IGAD has also been having his own issues as, you know, being a credible intervener. How maybe the solution might be regional forces, but we've also been seeing regional forces not really like in the south. So we see SODOC in Mozambique.
Yeah,
I think, I don't know if SODOC had, I don't know how much sources they had. Maybe it was just the Rwandan forces, but also we're seeing peace keepers in Congo being attacked and all of that. So I'm looking at the prospect of regional forces, regional stuff.
That conversation is definitely alive. You know, I mean, there was a proposal to send the East African Standing Force to the extent that there could be peacekeepers ever operational in Sudan. Could they be regional? Could they not be regional, part of this East African Standing Force? And IGAD and AU would both be involved. I mean, it's worth pointing out that in Sudan's history, IGAD was really the key leading regional entity, and also for South Sudan. And even when this war broke out, and in the period, the tumultuous political period that preceded it, IGAD was quick to make statements, quick to have a reaction. But when it comes to actually knocking heads together, so to speak, on a mediation, IGAD did not succeed. They created this thing called an extended mechanism where they got all these different countries with some stake in the situation in Sudan to be part of this mechanism. But then they had one meeting, and I don't think they then followed up. It kind of died out. And then meanwhile, we had South Sudan trying its own mediation and Egypt trying its own. So we're still at this stage of trying to figure out what the forum is. But I would not exclude the idea of regional forces. I've just not heard a lot of people be very optimistic that it will happen, but I think people are thinking about it. And I think, you know, it stands a chance, maybe more likely than UN troops. But that whole conversation about sort of where the troops come from and whether it's the UN or who's financing, you know, these missions. It's all, it's an active conversation, and it's also, it's complex. You know, I think efforts to raise money in the UN are being also impacted by what's happening now in this country. And political will, there's so many dynamics.
I agree with you on your assessment on East African standing force. What one of the contributors to the special issue that I'm editing particularly wrote on that, that standing force that was established in the 2000 and the issues that have been, you know, affecting it. But let's wind down. Let's come to the conclusion. I know this might be difficult, but I wanted you to ask you this last question to see. How do you see this conflict, like in the short, medium, long term? How do you see it ending? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel? How will it happen if there's going
to
be?
Let's end on that note. It's good to have that kind of question, because you got to force people to think about the solution and imagine the solution. I think the more people think about and talk about imagining a solution, maybe the more it can happen. I imagine that there will be a moment when the two sides can be convinced to start coming to talks. And there may be some preparatory work that has to happen behind the scenes, because there has to be some negotiation over the terms that would make them want to come to the table. So maybe there's already some stuff to talk about in terms of their own incentives. I'm no expert in that, but I could imagine that others are, and they would say, okay, well, you know, really, Burhan needs to be assured of X, Y, and Z. Hameti needs to be assured. Everybody talks about the soft landing. I'm not a fan of soft landings. I don't know how to analyze it, but I imagine that that's a scenario that could play out, and that that there are incentives enough for them to agree to come to the table. Does it mean that the country is sort of Libya style carved up for a while, for the next few years? While they're like not really active war, but not a peace situation, that is also a scenario. We have to see what happens in El Fasher in Darfur, because if RSF ends up taking over El Fasher, they have the entire west of the country. They may just say, you know, they've already said that they plan to declare, a group of civilians has already said that it plans to declare a government in RSF territories. So if that actually happens, as it is expected to happen, and if the RSF take over El Fasher in Darfur, then you do sort of have the makings of this Libya-style, two countries,
demarcation,
two areas, even within the same, with one territory. That situation could then prolong things. They could go on for quite a number of years, with the political economy kind of falling into place for both parties. That's something I'm concerned about, because I feel like it would make it longer. It would prolong things. And it prolongs the insecurity, the threat of war, the bad conditions, and so on. Another scenario would be that, there are unexpected gains by the military, and that that Al Fasher doesn't fall, and that the military makes major gains. and they go to a negotiation, this backdoor soft landing conversation that I don't know about. They go to that, and then they do kind of force a mediation to happen sooner rather than later. So we're all kind of at the edge of our seat watching how this could play out. What I would want to see happen is for it to be short, not long, for a negotiation to include some of the political conversations that were started during the transitional period that would envision putting into place a system of government and of principles that the Sudanese people all support and subscribe to, and that are inclusive and that make the entire community of people, which is very diverse, as you know, feel included in this new project, this new country. And that's part of what I had seen in the transitional government before the war, the beginnings of that conversation. And you know, we don't need to use grand terms like saying, oh, bring, you know, it's a automatically a functional democracy. No, it's a transition, and the transition needs to last a long time, but it needs to be more stable than the one that pre-existed this war, obviously. And that's because you know, it was so easy to destabilize the transition, in part because these security forces were not properly controlled. They were out of control. So there are a lot of dimensions to this.
Jan, this is very interesting. I also share your hope, and like Raleigh said, we need to imagine a peaceful resolution, a peaceful end to this, and then we can then wish that or into reality.
Yeah,
because a lot of people are suffering. There's a whole lot, so that we can, you know, deal with this or reach that in the shortest period of time rather than a long period whereby we prolong the suffering. But anyways, we're really grateful to have you join us. I really, really enjoyed this conversation.
Yes, and thank you for the great questions. And wow, I'm glad that you care about Sudan and want to talk about it.
Yeah, we do. Thank you very much. And then I'll be in touch with the other projects that we
please don't hesitate. I would love to have a conversation. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Jen. Have a lovely day.
Thanks, Michael. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you once again for tuning in to this week's episode on the war in Sudan, the humanitarian crisis, and the neglected war. As usual, join me to thank our guest, Jehan and Henry, for her commentary and useful analysis and insight into this neglected war. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.